Hello and welcome to the Southern Tour podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Chatwin, and today we're joined from Shanghai by Patrick Cranley. In the last episode, I was joined by Jenny Lin to talk about Shanghai's contemporary identity as a global city. Today, we'll dig a little deeper into Shanghai's past. First, though, an introduction. Patrick is managing director of China-based public relations company Asia Media and is president of Historic Shanghai, a group of city residents dedicated to the study of the city's social, economic, and architectural history. A frequent speaker on China business and historical topics, Patrick has written for dozens of publications worldwide. Patrick is also a member of the National Committee on US-China Relations and served for many years on the board of the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai. Patrick, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
One of the reasons I wanted to pick your brains on Shanghai is because you've lived there for certainly by expatriate standards, a long time. I think, am I right in saying that you've been there since the late 90s?
Well, that's right. I think it's 24 years this year.
And in that time, the city has changed enormously. And we'll perhaps talk a little bit about why Shanghai was a bit later developing compared to some of the cities in Guangdong province, for example. But I just wondered if we could start with a general question about what you've seen as positive change in the city and also perhaps some of the less positive change over those 24 years.
Sure. Well, on the positive side, you'd have to say that transportation, for instance, is greatly improved. And from the preservation point of view, there's been progress as well, because 25, 30 years ago, there was very little attention, very little awareness of the value of Shanghai's historic architecture. Neither was there a budget for protecting these really important old buildings and neighborhoods. But today, there's a much greater understanding of why Shanghai's architectural heritage is important. And there's also more money that can be directed toward preservation efforts. So plenty of progress. Of course, on the other side, there's a lot of Shanghai that has disappeared over the last 25 to 30 years. And once it's gone, it doesn't come back.
Yes, and I suppose one of the things we'll probably talk a bit about today is what's been lost. And I think one of the things that perhaps people don't know as well about Shanghai's history is its kind of earlier version as a Chinese walled city. I think possibly people are familiar with the Treaty Port era and the way the city was carved up by colonial powers in that phase of Chinese history. But before that, Shanghai was a walled city. If you look at old maps of the city, you can still make out, and even on contemporary maps, just about the old circular shape of the old city. Could you tell us a little bit about Shanghai's origins as a walled Chinese city?
Sure. You know, Shanghai's history goes back many, many hundreds of years. And what a lot of people don't realize is that it has been an important port city for a long, long time. It's strategically located near, but not on, the Yangtze River, which goes east and west through the whole country, third longest river in the world, I believe. And as a protected port near the mouth of the river, where it empties into the East China Sea, Shanghai is superbly located to play a role as an entrepôt port. It also is near where the main commodities, traded commodities in the last several hundred years were produced then too. That's the likes of tea, silk, and cotton. So even, 600 years ago, Shanghai was the most prosperous city, one of the most prosperous cities in the Yangtze River Delta region. And so those advantages served it well after the foreigners arrived in the middle of the 19th century. The wall, by the way, was built in the middle of the 1500s for protection against pirates, and was torn down shortly after the founding of the Republic of China, the fall of the Qing Dynasty in 1911, to make way for modern transportation. So the wall was part of Shanghai's skyscape, if you want to call it that, for only a couple of hundred years. And for the last 110 years, it hasn't existed. So it's an important phase. The walled city phase of Shanghai's history is important, but the history goes back even farther than the 16th century.
And it's interesting. I mean, I lived in Shanghai and I didn't realize for a long time that there had been a walled city there, which, you know, by comparison to somewhere like Beijing, where there's none of it left, but it's still a very oft invoked part of Beijing's history. And in Beijing, there are still sort of fragments that have been restored. Is there anything left for people to see of the old Shanghai wall?
Nothing to speak of. There's a couple of stones that some people say were part of the wall, but there's really nothing to see.
And is there much left of the city within it? I mean, some visitors to Shanghai will go to, example, Yuyuan, and there's a few other sites that might be well known. And as I said, if you look at contemporary maps of the city, you can just about, I suppose, if you know where it is, make out the shape, this circular shape. And certainly if you look at maps from the early 20th century, it's still quite evident. Subsequently, quite a lot of major roads have been built through it. What is there left architecturally of what was within the city walls?
Well, if you had come 30 or 40 years ago, you would have seen maybe 80 to 90% of what the foreigners called the old city, still intact. But there's been a great deal of redevelopment of the area inside the former city walls over the past 25 years. And well, what's left, I guess you could say, is bits and pieces. Now, that being said, 20 years ago, the approach to remodeling the city was primarily to raise big chunks of the city and replace old structures with, you know, new high rises and office buildings, et cetera, shopping centers. But in the past decade, there has been a realization that maybe Shanghai should keep more of its remaining architectural heritage. And this is actually a pattern that we see all over the world over and over again. As cities modernize and want to project that progress and often increase in economic status, they tear down old parts of cities as fast as they can. And then at some point, all over the world, people realize that the flavor of the old city, the art and architecture of the old city is disappearing, and someone starts a movement to preserve. And that has happened in Shanghai as well, concomitant with the increase in economic resources available to the authorities here. And the government authorities are the ones that hold the decision-making power in deciding which parts of the old city, which buildings will be preserved and which won't. So there's been a great deal of progress in awareness, and we're seeing that play out in the restoring, I guess you'd say, of some of these old buildings, which is great.
Yes, and I mean, I've noticed that in recent visits to the city. Obviously, there's a kind of precursor to some of this, the kind of realization of the commercial potential of the vernacular architecture, Xintian Di, which I talked to Jenny Lin about a couple of weeks ago, which is a sort of upscale shopping and leisure area modeled on the old Shukuman Shanghai architectural style. To what extent is that a sort of model for the preservation / restoration? Is it mostly turning those old, perhaps slightly dilapidated parts of the city into upscale lifestyle venues? Or is there perhaps, as well as that, some slightly more thoughtful preservation going on?
It's an excellent question. Xintian Di project, which was completed around the year 2000, was groundbreaking, and it was a revelation for a lot of Shanghai residents that type of traditional Shanghai style lane neighborhood architecture is valued by certain quarters, and at the same time could also be turned to economic profit. But unfortunately, that became the primary model for redevelopment. And the focus was on, you know, shopping and tourism, and not so much the preservation of buildings. I mean, Shin Tiandi is a very controversial project in preservation circles. Some preservationists think that it's an abomination because so much of that neighborhood was torn down, the fabric was destroyed, and none of the buildings returned to their original purposes. There is another school of preservationists that say, no, Shin Tiandi changed the way Shanghai people think about their old neighborhoods and caused preservation to be considered much more broadly by developers, by planners, et cetera. So, you know, the model was a double-edged sword. Fortunately, there are people in the planning and developing industries that are considering far broader range of potential reuses that are more respectful to the original fabric of neighborhoods and also the fabric of the buildings themselves.
I was reflecting on what you were saying about the move of cities internationally, where they go through a phase of destruction and then preservation. And I live in Birmingham, an old industrial city, and there's a huge amount of architecture here that was built during the boom era of the city in the 19th century. And a lot of it was destroyed. And in the centre of Birmingham now, they have the old Victorian back-to-back terraced housing, and that's overseen a small area of it by the National Trust, which some listeners will be familiar with, which is a British charitable organisation that dedicated to the preservation of architectural history. And some people say that's what China needs, is some sort of national approach to architectural preservation. What do you think about that? Is that something that there's more talk about, a sort of more joined up approach to architectural preservation in China?
Well, certainly there is and should be discussion of kind of the institutional challenges to good preservation practice. In China, unlike in certainly my native country, the United States, I'm not so familiar with the workings of the National Trust in the UK, but in China, you know, what we would call pressure groups or lobbying groups are not encouraged for a variety of reasons. So it is very difficult for people who are interested in architectural heritage to join together, formulate arguments, and present them to the decision makers, because the government does not allow that, essentially. So the avenues for promoting preservation are limited in China. Yes, there are institutional challenges to preservation here, and they should be addressed, but there's no clear path for that to happen. So the decisions are made by primarily government departments. For instance, in Shanghai, there's the, you know, Bureau of Planning, there's the Department of Construction, and there's also a department that's in charge of cultural affairs and management. But you can imagine which of those government operations have the most power. Yeah.
Yes.
And it's all about money, right?
Yes.
It is all about money. And it's always profitable for the government to redevelop land.
Yes.
Whether or not preservation is part of it.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about an area that I was lucky enough to visit with you on one of the historic Shanghai tours in the summer of 2019, I think was when I was there, which is the Laoximen area in the old city. And when I said, so that's what, 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago now. And when I was there, there was still a fair bit of the architecture left, although most of the residents had been moved on. I just wondered, I'm almost worried to ask, but what's left of that area, which was one of the last remaining areas of the old vernacular style of architecture in Shanghai? What's left there now? Has it all gone?
Well, both happy and sad to report that actually the Laoximen neighborhood, that means the old West Gate portion of the former walled city, that refers to the gate that went through the wall in the western part of it. The buildings are still standing. Almost every single one of the residents has been moved out. All of the windows and doors are bricked up, and we are waiting for the next phase. We don't know what the plans are. It's a very large area, as you remember, we walked through for quite some time. We don't know what the plans are. We don't know which buildings, if any, will be protected. But we do know that the current model for redeveloping of historic areas in Shanghai basically consists of tearing everything down except for a handful of buildings. The buildings that survive oftentimes will be literally picked up and moved to the side of the construction site and then incorporated after a number of years of sitting derelict into the final product. And then the developers can say, oh, see, we did a historic preservation project. So we assume that that's what's going to happen in the north part of the Old Westgate neighborhood. Now, about 2 years ago, about the time of your visit, the government announced a new policy. It said that it would preserve 90% of the Lane neighborhoods left, or it said 90% of the Lane neighborhoods. What they didn't say is that 90% are already gone. So 90% of 10% is 9%, if you ask me. And that means that, for instance, in the southern part of the Lao Shiman neighborhood, I don't think we walk through that. The plan is not to tear down the Lane houses, but to improve them with the residents in place, renovation in place, it's called. But as you know, from walking through the northern part of the neighborhood, it is impossible to renovate with all the residents still in place because the houses are not large and the number of residents is far more than they were designed for. So we don't know what's going to happen in that portion of the Old Westgate neighborhood, but we do have an example in the northeastern part of the city in Hongkou of a neighborhood where the authorities paid for the residents to move out and rent apartments for the better part of a year while their Lane homes were renovated. And then they were able to move back. That experiment is ongoing, and there are, supporters of that approach, and there are detractors as well. So the jury's still out on that model. So we'll see.
And the people who, we met a few of them that were sort of clinging on in the northern part of the Lao Shiman area, presumably they were being paid some compensation and relocated to sort of apartment buildings elsewhere. What were their attitudes to that process?
Right. So you can imagine in any neighborhood with thousands of residents, there's always going to be some who are not happy with what is offered to them in compensation for giving up their old residences and moving. Those types of everybody in the neighborhood is offered either a cash payment or a free apartment, but many hours away, or at least an hour and a half away, or some combination of those. The compensation is based on the living area of their current apartment in the old neighborhood. But many of those families have added floor space to their apartments by, for instance, building mezzanines. And their argument is, oh, well, you say you want to compensate us for an apartment of X square meters, but we think it should be X plus Y. And that kind of argument can go on for quite a long time. But many of those hangers-on that you saw when you visited are now gone. I can't think of any that are left. So the people that you see in the neighborhood now are part of the demolition team, or they are scavengers who are just looking for things that people threw away on the way out, or a few other stragglers who are, for instance, providing food to which they sell not to residents anymore, but to the demolition crews and things like that. So it's pretty grim at the moment, but it'll get grimmer when the bulldozers move in.
Yes, and it reminds me a little bit what you were talking about of the story of Xiong'an, the new your new city in Hebei when they announced the project to redevelop that area, which is mostly sort of small towns and villages. And everybody started building desperately quickly new mezzanines and floors to capitalize on the compensation worked out by square footage. One of the things that really interested me about that part of the city and the old Shanghai walled city in general was that the style of vernacular architecture that you saw in that area was a mixture of sort of Eastern and Western aesthetics that, you know, for me, somebody who's studied Beijing architectural history and the traditional form of the courtyard houses that's there, it sort of surprised me a little bit to see motifs and kind of design elements that were clearly drawn from Western architecture in the late 19th and early 20th century. And I wondered if you could just perhaps describe a little bit that style, the Shukuman style Shanghai architecture that is quite distinct and where those influences came from.
Sure. The style of architecture that was so common in Shanghai between the middle of the 19th century to the middle of the 20th century really is distinctive, as you mentioned. And that combination of East and West is what makes it so distinctively Shanghainese. Back in the middle of the 19th century, just at the beginning of the period of the foreign presence, there was a civil war going on in China. And some residents left the areas of conflict in the provinces and came to Shanghai because they thought it would be safer. You know, that's where the foreigners were with their big gunboats. These were not poor Chinese. These were well-to-do Chinese who were moving to protect their assets and their families. The problem was, of course, once they got to Shanghai, there was very little housing stock in which they could live. So some very quick thinking, mostly British entrepreneurs bought land, causing, by the way, the first big land price boom in recent Shanghai history. And they built housing developments that both would appeal to the Shanghainese residents or the Chinese residents who were moving in, and also incorporate some of the efficiencies of urban architecture, which they were familiar with from, for instance, London and Manchester, specifically the terraced houses that you're talking about. For American listeners, we would call them townhouses or row houses. Those were incorporated into a form specifically built for Chinese that was high density. But to appeal to the Chinese potential residents, they featured design elements or format elements that were familiar to Chinese, specifically, as you mentioned, courtyard style housing. So in a Shanghainese lane style, Shanghai style lane neighborhood, you approach from the street, you go through a gate, actually several gates in a city block, shall we say, allowing entrance to the neighborhood itself. Those gates could be locked off in times of stress. So the basic idea of these Shanghai style lane neighborhoods was safety, right? Because people were worried about civil unrest. So you walk in through a gate and from the main street and you're in a lane, and there's usually one main lane and then several lanes coming off perpendicular to that lane. And each of the houses along these lanes has its own entrance, but the neighbor, of course, is sharing one of the walls. And that's the feature that comes from terraced housing. The entrance to the homes is reminiscent of traditional Chinese style residences, where there is a stone door frame. And in this case, three pieces of stone with rounded corners at the top, typical of the Yangtze River Delta area, with wooden doors opening inward into a courtyard. A courtyard smaller than you would build perhaps in the countryside, but nevertheless giving light and air to an inner courtyard where washing and drying and all other things can happen. And then, at least in the early versions of Shanghai style lane neighborhoods, floor to ceiling doors that would open inward into a reception area. So very familiar format to a Chinese who had been living in a traditional home. Now, all of the ornamentation or decoration of these homes from the exterior was in Western style. I guess that might have been because the developers were more familiar with that than Chinese style. But very quickly, that became very fashionable in Shanghai, right? It was a modern element. It was a foreign element. It was intriguing, I guess. And that became sort of the model. So after the Civil War was ended, what the developers in subsequent years discovered is that a lot of the Chinese living in these neighborhoods really liked the approach. And so the Shanghai style lane neighborhood format was adopted and used for the next several decades. And it changed over time. You know, the courtyards got smaller, the building technology changed to reinforce concrete, et cetera. Mm. But the basic format of the lane neighborhood with access from the streets, lanes inside, houses sharing walls, and courtyards within, that remained until the 1940s, until the Second World War.
And if in terms of the scope of that style is roughly, I suppose, a century from what you're saying, between sort of middle of the 19th and the middle of the 20th century, what was the style of architecture that preceded the opening of Shanghai as a treaty port? What would you have seen in the late 18th century, say?
You would have seen courtyard houses for the wealthy and much more modest homes for the less well off. You would also have seen much more greenery. Actually, it's hard to imagine today, but even within the walls of Shanghai's city, there was green space. There were pastures, there were gardens, there were farm animals. So the city was far less populated at that time, maybe 100 or so thousand people in the whole Shanghai area. And outside of the city walls was countryside in areas that today are packed full of thousands of skyscrapers. It was villages and streams and temples as far as the eye could see.
I wondered if we could just change direction slightly and talk about some of the other areas of the city that listeners might be less familiar with. But I wondered whether you could tell us of some of the perhaps lesser known architectural areas and gems that are worth seeking out beyond the obvious parts of the city that visitors might already be familiar with.
Sure. Well, you know, our group, Historic Shanghai, runs walks in different parts of the city just about every weekend. And we cover the entire area around the central core. So beyond the Bund and the Old City, there is the northern part of the city, Hongkou. Well, Shanghai's got a number of districts. So Hongkou District, east of Hongkou, there's Yangpu District, which was an industrial area. And it's becoming easier to walk around that area, although much of it is also going down. But out there, there's everything from electrical power plants to water treatment plants to warehouses, to shipyards, textile factories. And alongside those factories are neighborhoods that were built by some of these companies to house the people to staff those facilities. So there's lots of history out in the former industrial areas. Just straight north of the city, outside of the boundaries of the former international settlement, was a very bustling area, which was heavily populated by Japanese residents in the old days, immigrants from southern China. There was a Cantonese Baptist church. That's another thing people don't really realize, is the religious history of Shanghai is as interesting and international as many other aspects of its history. So missionaries from all over the world were here, every denomination you can imagine, and the legacy of their efforts in China remain in many cases. So Catholic churches and, you know, the other types of operations affiliated with the Catholic missionary enterprise, like libraries and hospitals, orphanages and convents, schools. And the same goes for some of the Protestant missions. And then, you know, there are also Buddhist temples and Taoist temples, and even a couple of mosques that can be visited around the city. To the west, outside of the former foreign settlements, there was also development, especially by well-to-do Chinese, beautiful homes. Actually, the famous author J.G. Ballard and his family lived outside of the formal boundaries of the international settlement in an area which also had the homes of many well-to-do Chinese. And out in the western part there, we also like to do tours to show people that area. In Pudong, which is a very large area, there is less historic architecture that's obvious. But if you travel an hour east of the Huangpu River in the eastern district that's called Pudong, all the way almost to the ocean, you can get to a small town called Quansha, which is reasonably, there are some reasonably well-preserved parts of that. And you can see a little bit about what a satellite town, a country town would have been like in those days. Very interesting parts to visit, not just downtown. And it takes some time. A lot of tourists come here and they say, oh, well, how much time do I need in Shanghai? You know, 2 days, is that enough?
Yeah.
Well, I've been here 24 years and I'm still learning.
And it is a city that is, as with many of the tier one Chinese cities, absolutely enormous in the surface area that it covers. And in recent years, the last couple of years, the Chinese government have announced population caps for Beijing and Shanghai as well, in an effort to limit the overall population of the city. And I just wondered if we could finish with a question about the future for the urban format of Shanghai and whether there's a change in approach in terms of Beijing. They're looking to spin off some of the what they call non-capital functions to other local cities, including Xiong'an, this new city they're building to the south. What's the Shanghai government's plan for, well, first of all, meeting and keeping that population cap, but for urban development generally? Have they got a kind of similarly ambitious or sort of synthesized idea of what Shanghai is going to look like in 10, 15 years?
Yes, well, I think Shanghai has actually made a lot of progress already in that direction. It is no longer an industrial city. It was the first city in China to generate more than half of its annual GDP in the service industries. So a lot of the manufacturing is already gone and has been gone for many years. So this is and will remain a service-oriented or service-driven economy. The transportation infrastructure is already pretty much in place. With respect to office buildings, of course, there's plans for thousands more. There's already thousands been built. But I think that may slow down a little bit. With respect to population control and planning, my understanding is, and I'm not an expert in that field, that the plan starting about a decade ago was to actually depopulate the core of Shanghai, the central area, but to maintain the population of the entire municipality, which is very, very large, at about the same number, you know, 25, 26 million. They don't want the population to increase much more than that, because I guess they figure that the infrastructure is adequate for that number, and anything more will gum up the works. So how they control the population here is a mystery to me. Of course, in the old days, the household registration system was extremely effective in eliminating much movement around the country at all. You stayed where you were unless you got permission from your work unit to move. And that was very, very difficult. But now my understanding is that of the 25 or so million people that are in Shanghai, only about 15 million of them have the legal right to be here. That is household registration in Shanghai. And that leaves many, many millions in the so-called floating population, some of whom are here on temporary work permits, like the construction workers that are building all these high rises. And those folks are expected to return to their home places after the contract is finished. But there's also several million, they call them the migrant population, people who have made a strategic decision to leave their home place where their household registration is legal and come to the big city, because their calculus is they can earn more here, though, you know, sort of under the radar, than they can back in their village where they may be involved in agricultural work, for instance. Now, how the government manages that total population and meets these targets is a bit of a mystery to me. Perhaps you can have another guest on to talk about that.
Yes, I mean, I think there's a view that these population caps, certainly in Beijing, are being used as a way of kicking out some of the, in the Chinese government's view, less desirable urban residents. And there's been a swathe there of kind of closing markets or apartment buildings, that shopping areas that cater to that community. But we'll pause there for today, Patrick. It's been fascinating to talk to you as ever. Listening to you describe some of the other architectural areas of Shanghai makes me long for the opportunity to be back in Shanghai. I suspect that may be a little distant in my future for the moment. But for other listeners who may be heading to the city or there already, I would really encourage people to have a look at the Historic Shanghai website, which is historic-shanghai.com. And there's lots of information there about the tours that Patrick and others lead in Shanghai. And all that remains for me to say today is thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, and we wait for your next visit to Shanghai when that's possible.
Yes, me too. Thanks very much, Patrick.